So, all right, we are in the 18th chapter. We did go through verse 8 last week. Verse 9 begins a portion. Remember, we're talking about the fall of Babylon, particularly in this chapter, the economic and the political Babylon and the fall of that. More in 19, you'll see the fall of political Babylon, because that's when Jesus comes back. That's when Antichrist loses power. But in 18, it's more, the flavor really is more economic. So what we're going to look at today is we're going to see that the whole world is going to mourn the fall of Babylon. Why? Well, none of us were around in 29, right? I think one person in our church, at least, was. Marie was, wasn't she? She's 97.
What are you saying? 1929.
And that was the crash. But you, historically, all of us know some of the things that happened that day. Remember? People killed themselves, and you know, it was devastating and stuff like that. So John's going to tell us that the whole world's going to mourn when the economic Babylon falls. Why? Because that's where their security is, and that's where they've been taught their security is. If you think even about our country and stuff and the things that are happening economically now, lives have been devastated because the impact of losing all the assets that we have just overwhelms people. Certainly it would be hard for any of us to lose all of our assets at one time. There's no doubt about that. But at some point we have to realize that those things are not very stable, and all of it could be taken very easily, very quickly. I remind you that hard currency, which would include gold and stuff like that, is very rare. Very few people have that type of thing. Now, some people say, "Well, I just keep dollars available." But if the dollar crashes, your paper money is not what I would call hard currency. Okay, and we talked about the reality of this economic system. It will be, I'm convinced, it will be almost entirely electronic in nature. And we're almost there anyway. Because most of us never see even paper money. Most of our money is just run through electronic system in our banks. And to the people that we owe money to, we don't actually send them money. Matter of fact, they get pretty mad if you send them money. Don't send us cash, you know, type of thing. They don't want that cash and stuff. And so when that crashes, I guess I want to say with this electronic, can you see how false a sense of security we actually have? We're trading electronic impulses and assume that's our wealth, which kind of, you know, if you really think of it, whether it's electronic impulses or pieces of paper with presidents' pictures on it or a piece of rock out of the ground, how unstable is all of that? You know, and it's crazy what we value. Now, I understand the need for trading and purchasing and stuff like that. I'm not completely ignorant of those things, but it's interesting that those things become what people value. I always thought, you know, when you think about heaven, the streets paved with gold. So the most valuable thing we find here on earth that we base riches on in heaven is asphalt. So hey, that's pretty good. So you're going to be walking all over it. So verse 9, the reaction of the kings and the people of the earth. And it says, "And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her. They will see the smoke of her burning." Because when you lose everything of value, what do you have to rest upon? And when your whole life and your whole system has been built upon material things, when those material things have no value, which, by the way, they really have no value except for the value, they have no intrinsic value. They have the value that society places upon them. And when society crumbles, then anything that society has established as valuable, you know, has to crumble with it. That makes sense to you? So when that happens, where are these kings of the earth? Where's this last time society? Where are they going to turn to when nothing that they have put their whole life into, they have built their whole life around, it's what they live for. When it ceases to exist or ceases to have any value, what's going to happen? Well, the only thing that can happen, they're going to be broken. They're not going to know where to turn. There's nowhere for them to turn. You know, we as Christians, I hope we see the material blessings of God, including the money that God might pour into our life, we see them as tools. And that's what they are. They're tools. They're useful tools, and God can use them for His kingdom's work. We know that. But they should never rule us. They should never be the place where we find our security. They should be seen for what they are. So if they do disappear, and the time is going to come when they do disappear, that we're not shaken because of that happening. At least we're not shaken to a place where we say we have no hope. We will always have hope. Verse 10, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." So, what does this tell you when he says it's 1 hour? Remember the city of Babylon, it's not a literal city that he's speaking of here, the crumbling of this literal city. He's speaking of the system. He's speaking of the crumbling of the system. Even when he talked about end time religious Babylon, he called it a city too, remember? And now he calls this a city also. It's all tied together. It's that three-legged thing we've always talked about. But notice what he says, in 1 hour it's going to fall. Now, what does that 1 hour mean? It doesn't literally mean 60 minutes. What it means is, when it happens, it's going to happen quickly. It's going to, well, the term used in 1929 was crash. A few years ago, I can't remember exactly how long ago it was. Maybe you remember this. I was sitting at the hospital with Tim Bushnell because Judy was in there getting her, you know, the liver checked out to see about transplant and all that kind of stuff. And we were sitting there, and they happened to have the news on in the waiting room, and Fox Channel was on there and stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, they put those little runners or whatever across there, and they were showing the stock market. You remember this? When it dropped like 400 points in one day, and Tim and I are sitting there looking, you see what I'm seeing? That thing's going down, you know? And the way they've set up the stock market, supposedly when it drops so much, it shuts down. But somehow that day it didn't, and it lost like 400 points in one day, and it was kind of a, you know. Well, the stock market today, how many of you play the stock market? Gamblers? Okay. I have some. If you have any retirement, you're probably in the stock market somewhere. So, but it is overinflated. You understand that? It is artificially overinflated. It is being kept down by the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve are again artificially keeping interest rates down, keeping the cost of gold down. So the stock market, by keeping the stock market up, but it can't stay there forever. Just like, remember the housing thing. When you artificially inflate something, it can't stay inflated forever. It's got to burst. Something's got to pop. Okay, so it's going to happen to the stock market, and there's no stability, because think about this: our stability economically as a nation rests on the words of few people, the chairman of the Federal Reserve goes on there. She said, it's a she now, right? Yeah. So she goes on and says some things, and interest rates shift a little bit, and things happen a little bit. The banking thing happens. It's not based on anything real. It's based on someone sitting there and speaking to Congress. Or if the president goes out and make a certain type of, no matter who the president is, if he goes out and make a certain type of speech, you'll see the stock market do this. So it's based upon words, not upon real value. It's kind of a scary time that we live in when it comes to this. Maxine?
Because one of the biggest things is they're printing money we don't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, yeah. And our money is not backed by anything except for those words.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And most of you, I've shared this before, most of you remember a time when you had a dollar bill, it either had some gold lettering on it or silver lettering on it. It was called a gold certificate or a silver certificate, which meant that that dollar bill supposedly had that same amount of silver or gold in reserve. That's why they call it the reserve, Federal Reserve. In reserve that backed that paper money. That's what that gold or silver certificate. Anybody remember gold or silver certificates? Okay, I have one. Someone gave me one because I taught about it one time. They handed me one. But so that's the way it used to be set up. Our money used to be backed by the gold or silver in Fort Knox, and they were restricted to printing based on how much gold or silver was in Fort Knox. Well, when the gold standard fell, was that in the 70s? I think it was sometime in the 70s. The gold standard fell, which simply meant this: we removed our monetary system off the gold standard. Not based upon gold anymore. Not based upon any hard currency. And we turned our dollars into promissory notes that were only backed by the good faith of the government of the United States of America. So do they have any real intrinsic value? Where before you could say, yeah, at least they had the intrinsic value of whatever gold was or silver was at that time. It's not that way anymore. You don't have anything backing your dollar except for what society says it's worth. And by the way, we've moved to the place of a global economy. So now it's not just our government that determines the value of our dollar. The whole world determines the value of our dollar. If the European Common Market does what they say they're going to do, that is move from the dollar being the standard currency to the Chinese money to back their currency, the dollar's value, the dollar's value will go, it can't help but go down. Okay? Because it has no intrinsic value. It just has the value of what society is willing to put upon it. It's going to be interesting times. So, anyways, so 1 hour, which means crash. That I like that word. It's going to be a crash. When the end time economic system comes to a crash, to an end, it will happen very quickly. That's the 1 hour that he speaks of. Verse 11, and the merchant of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Why? Well, how do you buy what you... Yeah, you know, the whole system has imploded upon itself. It has to. It's based upon a false premise. And that false premise is not just... Again, I want to say it's not just in the United States. It is globally. We are establishing a global economy right now that's based solely upon nothing. You can't go find what deems or what determines value upon the monetary system across the world. You can't go find it. It doesn't exist. If you were going to do a little Indiana Jones and go try, I got to find out what backs the money, what backs the Chinese money, what backs the European money, what backs those things. There is nothing there. You talk about a shadow government, or you know those kind of things, and people think you know you're being kind of making a bunch of conspiracies up. But really, I mean, really, I challenge you this week. Go find out what's backing the monetary system worldwide, and if you find something, please let me know. And what you find cannot be merely because a government says this is what their money's worth. Whether that government be a regional government or a global government, because their word is nothing. Everybody got that? Anybody else besides me concerned when the CDC says something like, well, don't worry about Ebola? Really? Or Ebola, whatever, however you want to describe. You know, the Center for Disease Control saying, oh, you don't have to worry about Ebola. Well, why do you still have flights coming in from Western Africa where the Ebola virus is happening? How'd this guy get in here in Dallas and stuff? Yeah. And last week I watched him it's not lunchtime, so I tell you, this guy kind of threw up all over the place because of the sickness. And you would expect them to show up with hazmat. And what do they show up with? The guys are wearing Bermuda shorts, are out there with mops and buckets cleaning up this guy's vomit. I'm real secure that they know how to take care of us, you know. This is where we live. There is no security because they can't offer security. When our president, when any president stands up and says, we'll take care of you, we'll keep you secure, they can't. How do you keep that border secure? You can't keep it. Unless you put guys, troops every few feet, you can't do it. You know, the fence will not do it. Slow it down, but it will not do it. These are times where really we Christians need to understand that our security is in Jesus. That doesn't mean we don't do wise things here on earth. Of course we do. But our security ultimately is in Jesus. Because if you put it in anything else, everything else will and can, eventually it will, fail you. Mary.
There's also a big epidemic with the kids with respiratory.
No. Yeah,
there was another boy once bet fine, the next morning he was gone.
Well, and that's what they're talking. You know, the Bible talks about the pestilence and the things that will happen. We have such hybrid diseases because we have not treated them properly. You know, I like a little picture I saw on Facebook. A little kid just covered with mud. Cute little kid, just covered with mud, and said something like, "The best immune defense that you can possibly have." You know, what we do is we sanitize everything, and because it seems clean to us and stuff. But some of those germs are not bad for us. Some of them build resistance within us. You know, I know it's hard to believe. I was in the dirt and mud most of my life, and that stuff. You know, but okay. This is a real world when you look at this passage here of the things that are going to happen. And again, I would say again, we live in a time when you can actually see these things happen worldwide. Before, it would not make any difference to you or I. What if the Saudi Arabian economy fell? Who cared? Mm-hmm. I would even say in our lifetime, if the Chinese economy 30 years failed, who cared? But we can't say that anymore because we are so interconnected. If something like the Chinese economy fails, that's why people say, why does our government keep pumping money into the Chinese economy? Because it can't afford for it to fail. You can't. The same thing in Europe and every place else. You can't afford for it to fail. And that's one reason why we have not just, if you look at the clock, our international debt is approaching $18 trillion. It's a number that's so staggering you can't even, it's hard even to comprehend. Okay? So, again, $18 trillion that only have value because the government says it has value. And the world is willing to receive it as valuable. Because the moment they say we no longer receive your dollars, then you got 18 trillion pieces of paper that are worthless. Doesn't matter whose president's picture's on the front of it. Okay, verse 12. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon and incense and fragrant oil and frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and the souls of men. So you see. The extent of what is sold basically on the market here, up to and including bodies, okay, and ultimately the souls of men. Verse 14, and the fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The fruit there is not an apple. Okay? It's kind of like that Genesis revelation similarity. It is the thing that your soul longs for. You know, the fruit of the tree, what was that? You know, like I said, it's not the trouble in Eden was not so much the fruit in the tree, but the two nuts on the ground. You know, so it's not what the fruit was. It's what your soul longs for. And here we come to the end of Revelation, and he uses that same terminology, the fruit, in that verse, verse 14, the fruit that your soul longed for, that thing which you desire, and actually desire more than anything else, more than life itself, more than God, certainly. And all of a sudden, it's gone. Now, if it really is what your soul is longed for, if it really is that valuable to you, when it's gone, what do you have left?
Nothing.
And nothing. Nothing. Well, I've got my family. No, probably not. You'll have nothing. Or they'll have nothing in that day. Everything will be taken away from them. Questions or comments on that? Verse 15. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in one hour such great riches came to nothing." So what all these people who got rich and gained advantage over other people and we know cheated people and all these kind of things, what are they doing? They're standing back. Because the destruction that's taking place of the economic system, there's not a thing that they can do about it. And of course, as it says here, they're going to be weeping and wailing because for them, that's their lifeblood. And think about this. You know, some people are so keen on either a communistic or a socialistic system. That is basically, in the purest form, everybody's equal. Now, that has never worked. In every socialistic country, Russia and the communist China and stuff like that, there have always been people who are more equal than others. Every man's system, there's always been people. You know, even in our system, we haven't always been fair or recognized people as being equal. So. It seems today people want to go back to this kind of socialist type mentality. Let's make it equal across the board, equal outcome across the board. Let's guarantee equal outcome. I tell you, even if we move to that system, there will still be that ruling class that will always be. And the same thing when it comes to here. I think Antichrist will push that. I really do. I think that's what he'll push. We'll take care of you. The world government will take care of you. Everybody will be equal. Nobody will want for anything. But even in that, there'll still be the ruling class. We see it right here with these merchants. Okay? But when everything crashes, guess what they're finally going to get? They're going to get their equality. Not in the sense of a paradise, but a sense of hell on earth, where nobody has anything. Isn't that incredible? What man has wanted, man is going to get. They're not going to like it when they get it. It's not their view of what their approach to life and economics and stuff like that. It's not their idea of what it should be. But they're going to get what they want. I'm convinced that if we followed biblical economics, we'd be a lot better off. We'd care for the poor. We'd take care of the elders. I mean, we would. We'd do all of those things. We wouldn't have to worry about it. But greed has found its way even into the body of Christ. Churches, you know, how many of you remember the Baptist Foundation of Arizona? Some of you remember that? This church lost over $60,000 in that. You know, men who say, "Trust us with your money," and then they're doing a Ponzi scheme. The money doesn't exist. The properties don't exist. You know, my mother-in-law, she lost about $80,000 of that, you know. So, and many people lost a whole, they lost everything. Okay? Now, there's a side of me that also says, you know what? You got to be a little bit reasonable. Something's got to be working your head a little bit. If people are getting like 6% interest at that time, and you have some group that's offering you 12% interest, somewhere you got to think, well, wait a minute, something's not sort of leveled out here. So, but my point is the greed that finds its place in men's hearts, and if we would respond biblically, I think the poor would be taken care of. I think, you know, there was a time when many, many hospitals were actually Christian-based hospitals. You know, but that becomes very hard. I know the Catholic Church, which is probably the largest group even today that still has hospitals. The Baptists across the board have pretty well liquidated their hospitals. There used to be a Phoenix Baptist Hospital, and you know, it's just the regulations are too much, and even when you talk to nurses that are not in religious hospitals anymore, they spend most of their time on the computer doing all the paperwork and not able to take care of their patients like they would want to. So it's an interesting time, and again, the basis of this is a false sense of what is valuable and greed that is bred because of that false sense. And when everything crashes, even the rich have nowhere to go. Even those who have taken advantage of the system, when the system crashes, they have no advantage. They have nothing. They're going to have a huge fall. All right? So, verse 18. And cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, "What is like this great city?" Now that expression can be taken two ways. What is like this great city? They're lamenting, you know, the loss. There was no city like this great city. Remember, it's not just a city, it's a system. The system is destroyed. What is like this system? How could it be? Or it could be they're overwhelmed with the destruction of the city, and they're saying, you know, we can't believe basically that anything could ever destroy. We had all our security, so where are we going to run? Where are we going to hide? Type thing. So you can look at that little phrase a couple different ways. Either way, it's not a happy ending. Verse 19, and they threw dust on their heads, and they cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, "Alas, alas, the great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she is made desolate." And some translations put it this way, in 1 hour she is laid waste. So the whole, what you see is that they're lamenting the fall of the economic system. So we've dealt with two legs here. First leg, the fall of religion. Now we're dealing with the second leg, that is the fall of economics. Chapter 19, we will deal with the fall of the political system overall. So everything that Babylon represents is crumbling before the eyes of men. And ultimately what Babylon represents, as we talked about, is power. Power that says, "God, we don't need you. We don't need you." And God is letting them have their day. And what they're going to find, what they're finding out is nobody can survive without God. No system, no people, no individual can survive without God. Why? Let's go back to a basic truth. It's a basic truth. Man was created for God. We were created by God, but we were also created for God. And for us to reject either one of those things, okay, leads to our own destruction. That's the message of the Bible, ultimately. You know, and because of sin, remember we talked about how sin entered in and man was separated from God, but God didn't change his plan. We were created for him, by him, for him. He sent his son. And so we have the opportunity, as the Holy Spirit leads us, to respond to God and trust in His Son for our salvation. We don't do that. That, once again, is a rejection of God who has created us for Him, or who has created us for Him. We were created by Him and for Him. Okay? So, that's part of our message is to the world. Jesus came to redeem us, to buy us back to God through His work on the cross. If you reject that, you're rejecting not just Jesus and the cross, but you're rejecting God. If you reject God, you're bringing destruction upon your own head. Not only for the temporal world, but also for eternity. And that is the message that's even played out here in man's systems that say, we don't even believe God exists. We certainly are not going to live for a God we don't believe exists. So what will they do? Well, because man is innately religious, they'll create a God of their own. In this case, he will be Antichrist. guess what he won't be able to do? He won't be able to save religious Babylon, he won't be able to save economic Babylon, and he won't be able to save political Babylon. Because he has no power to do those things. Only God can do those things. How desperately do people need God more than they need their next breath? What's the mission of the church? To share the message of the gospel with a world that for the most part, I guarantee you, for the most part, have no recognition of their need for God. Because they have been taught, and this message grows stronger every day, they have been taught they don't need God. They've been taught there really is no God. You are a cosmic accident. A couple of amoebas bumped together in an ancient ooze, and you sort of developed out of that. That's what you are. You don't need God. God didn't make you. And even if God made you, he's not a personal God who really cares about you. And he's not an infallible God. At every corner, it's being attacked. But the point is to move society to the place where they would stand as one and say, God, we don't need you. And it's happening. It's happening in our country. Again, when the highest court of the nation makes decisions that are clearly contrary to God's holiness and God's righteousness. I never said the court was religious. I never even said the court was biblical. But from a merely, even from a merely, what I would say, a secular basis, for man to make decisions that do not just merely ignore God, but actually snub God. We got some real issues. And unfortunately, many Christians don't see it, so they just sort of walk around in their little daze and say, it's really bothersome to me that Christians have become so detached from the impact of sin. Because we are here, I said Sunday morning, we are here to be the salt and the light. If we're not the salt and the light, Jesus says, then we have no use. Actually,
I was going to say, you use the word secular. I was wondering if we could use the word civil.
That might be a good word. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they really, secular... Oh, then you're already into
Actually, the word has moved to where you're taking it now. Mm-hmm. Previously, we wouldn't have had trouble using secular. What we would just say is they weren't a religious court. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Secular today means so much more than that. It's almost to the place of secular means almost absent of God. Mm-hmm. And civil would probably be a better term, yeah.
In other words, that should be fairness for everybody.
Yeah, of course. And there's a sense of morality, and you think about it, I would not say that our country is a religious based country. I don't think it was ever meant to be a religious based country, but the precepts of which our country was set upon were set upon the understanding that there is a law that's higher than man's law. And there is a created being that, whether they have a personal relationship, there was at least that acknowledgement is what I'm saying. We move to a place where that's where we're moving is where there's not even acknowledgement of that. And basically you get back to the book of Judges, everyone does what's right in their own eyes, which in a modern day term leads to a thing called anarchy.
It's like with Jeremiah, when Jeremiah was telling them, you have to get back to what the Lord told you to do, mm-hmm. and everything, and he kept telling them, and the people just ignored him, they wouldn't, and everything else, until God finally got tired of it and washed his hands of them and said, don't even bother praying anymore for them, because I'm not going to listen.
But I always say, none of us would actually want to be Isaiah or Jeremiah. Because in both of their commissions, God says, I'm sending you out to people who will not listen to what you have to say. Mm-hmm. They're not going to listen to what you have to say. Sometimes we pastors can get discouraged when it seems like people are not responding or listening or hearing and stuff. And then for me, when I get to that place, I'm not really a person that gets discouraged very easily and stuff. But when it happens, and it does happen every once in a while, usually God takes me back to these guys and say, well, how would you like to be? You might even, Pat, Tony, you might have one person say, good, you know, I got the message, got it, you know, but how would you like to be these guys, you know? Because really, you think about from the very initiation of their call to be prophets, God told them, I'm going to send you to people who will not hear what you're saying, but you still got to go. You still got to share. You have to share with integrity. You can't change the message because it's not a popular message. And which is my great concern about so many churches and pastors, even pastor friends I know today, who refuse to stand and refuse to share a message with integrity because it's not popular. And because they're receiving, I know they receive pressure from people within their church communities and stuff who say, you know, don't say that, you know, you need to back off and stuff like that. All pastors receive those kind of pressures. I don't know if you're aware of that. I've had people say, I'm gonna quit giving, and, you know, and my response usually has been, you know what? First of all, I don't know whether you give or not. And if you did give, I don't know how much you give and don't want to know that. And thirdly, you're not giving to me anyway. So if you want to do something like that, that's between you and God. But I've had people even in this church that have left our church that says, you know, you're too negative. The term they would rather use is negative. We're going to go to a place where it's not all, you know. So, well, if that's all you've heard in 8 years, then, you know, this is the time that we're in. And each pastor will have to decide, are they going to stand or are they going to give in, even to the pressures that are within the church organization? Because what will happen is the popularity of, particularly in smaller churches like ours, sometimes the bigger churches can weather these things. But the smaller churches, you know, in a smaller church like ours, if 20 people decide to get mad and leave, it's pretty, if 20 people left from, you know, City of Grace or something like that, nobody would even know it. It wouldn't, even, you know, it, but, so these are the interesting times and stuff. And so you have to stay the course. Someone asked me the other day, well, how would you like to fit into a system like the City of Grace? And I said, that's not my call. You know, my call is, God has called me to be a pastor. And I know sometimes some of those pastors of those big places, they really can't be a pastor to their people. They're almost the executive of, you know, do they have a place? Of course they have a place. But it's not my call. I want to be able to talk to people. I want my office to be open. I want them to know me, and I want to know them. But that's my call. Some of these guys have different calls. We've got to be willing to stay the course. If we make these statements, if I'm the last one standing, I'm going to stay the course. Well, that's easy to say when everything's going good. It's a whole other thing when you see people, you know, whole groups of people leaving and stuff, and say, well, you know what, this isn't what it used to be. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know the church will be what it used to be as we continue to focus on, you know, is your commitment to what God has or your commitment to where the crowd's moving. So, Mary.
I ask you to talk just a little bit. I know you probably want to get to the end of this chapter, but if you...
I gave up doing that a long time ago.
talk a little bit about the difference and how it fleshes out that God judges us individually by the motivations of our heart versus how God judges nations and how, as he judges a nation, it affects those people of the nation. And I'm wondering if the Old Testament examples of that are a valid example for today, case in point, Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham saying, but if there's one, you know, or but if there's two, you know.
Interesting, when Abraham talked with God over that, and God's willingness not to destroy it for just a few, when he got down to a few, there wasn't anybody.
Right.
Lot is called righteous there. But every action that you see Lot do after that kind of brings into question, you know, this time. But Lot was righteous because apparently Lot did have a relationship with God. Lot had his own issues and stuff. And God allowed Lot and his family to be brought out of there before he brought destruction. I think it's a picture for us. God's going to bring destruction. I think he's going to take us out of here before it happens. But getting back to that thing, there's no question that when God judges a nation or judges corporately, that even the remnant, the true believers, are affected. And we have to realize that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have to realize. So if God judged the United States, let's just say God judges the United States and he pours out his wrath upon the United States, there's no way that Christians within the United States would not be affected by that.
Right.
Just like we're affected when the enemy does things. Okay? So we're required, I think, to realize where our security is. Let's go back to keeping this in mind. Let's go back to ancient Rome. After the time of Christ, in the first and second centuries. Let's just go back there for a little bit. And actually in the second, third centuries, basically. What happened? Okay, society changed. The Roman society got more and more demonic. I'm going to say it. It's hard to believe when you know what they were doing before that. But really, they fell from within. And let me say, they were falling from within. Again, it didn't happen overnight, but the corruption and the base way that they lived their lives and everything we're seeing today in our own society being okay and being glorified, not just okay, but being glorified. And you saw in the second and the third century Rome turning vehemently against anything that was righteous and good. Now, I believe Rome was under the judgment of God. I also believe God was there for his remnant, his people, blessing them. And the church grew tremendously in the second, third century, even though they met in caves and they struggled and stuff like that. So God's hand was upon them and the Holy Spirit was moving in a great way and stuff. But at the same time, the persecution of the church grew bigger under God's judgmental hand being falling on Rome. Okay, so it can't help but affect us. It can't help but affect us. For the individual, we Christians as individuals and stuff, we bring a lot of things upon ourselves. And I would say this more of in a discipline way than a judgment way. We bring things upon ourselves because we don't trust God. However, that fleshes out. God says something, we don't trust him. God leads us, we go another way, whatever it is. God has given us word about how we should live our life, and we say, well, I'll live it the way the world lives it. Well, that's a decision we make that will actually bring the chastisement of God upon us. Okay? I wrote a thing yesterday. I think you read the thing yesterday. When you read Romans chapter 1, and it was in response to the Supreme Court thing, and when you read Romans chapter 1, many people see that, I think they read it backwards. What they say is, because of homosexuality, God brings judgment upon a people. I read it differently. I read the proliferation of this gay agenda, this sodomite agenda, this celebration of it. I see it as, like Paul, I think Paul does in Romans chapter 1, he sees it as the judgment of God. Because what he says in Romans chapter 1, he says, God will give them over to a debased mind. Why? And he tells you why. He says, because they love the creation more than they love the Creator. The judgment of God is poured out on not because of homosexuality. I would say that a nation that moves to the place where they celebrate homosexuality, sodomy, and every corrupt kind of sexual deviancy that we're seeing today, that is a result of God's judgment. It's not. We always think that's what brings God's judgment, and certainly God is not accepted, but it is a result of God's judgment. What's he do? He hands them over to a debased mind to do, and Paul says it, to do things with each other that are abominable. And why? Because they have forgotten that they were created by God and they were created for God. And so they begin to worship not God anymore. They begin to worship created things. Like the list that we saw here of the Babylonian system. all the gold and all the spices and all, even the human body and even the selling of souls. That's people's lives. That's what they strive for. And because a society can get to that place, God says, basically, there comes a time when He will hand them over to a debased mind. And they'll do every kind of corrupt thing. You know, the door is open. It is kicked open. Don't be deceived. It has been kicked open. This is not a small thing. When you destroy the biblical, and I would even say the historic definition of marriage, anything goes. When those things begin to crumble, then marriage has no meaning today. Once our courts okayed homosexual marriage, then marriage has no meaning anymore. What I mean by that, it has whatever meaning you want. So if you want to marry your tree, you can marry your tree. You want to marry your dog, you can marry your dog. You're a pedophile and you want to marry some little kid, you can do that too. You watch. When man becomes so debased in his nature that there is no goodness, there is no righteousness, there's not even a sense of shame anymore, then anything goes. We're not evolving, we are deteriorating, and it has happened rapidly. I always say this, in the 1980s when I was pastoring my first church, and I share some messages with the church, and I say, you know what? I'm watching. I've been raised in the church and I'm watching, and it seems like something happens in society. Society accepts something that's never accepted before. I'm talking society as a whole. It loses its sense of shame. It's no longer, quote, in the closet. It's no longer hidden. You don't hide anymore. And I said this in 1980. Within 10 years, it's accepted in the church. But that's no longer true. It doesn't take 10 years any longer. Because the church has become so much like the world that it's almost instantaneously accepted in the church. I have people say to me, you wrote this thing about homosexuality, about being a sin and stuff. Don't you realize, Pastor, that I have loved ones that are homosexuals? How can you be so hateful? And you know, and what I want to say to them, well, I do too. So, you know, I have nephew and I have others, you know. And I said, you know what? I said, it's not about hate. It's about truth. And I read this morning in my daily Bible, Jesus said, you know what? Don't think that I've called you, and when I call you, it's basically going to make your life easy. Mm-hmm. Because what I've called you to is going to separate you. It's going to separate father from child. You know, and he gave a long list there and stuff. In other words, it's going to set you at odds. If you have people in your family that have a worldly mindset and you have a godly mindset, automatically you're at odds. Okay. But how do we respond to that? So I have a nephew. I don't hate my nephew. I love my nephew. I pray for my nephew. I want him to come to that place. Okay? So, the question is not, should we love or not love? The question is, how should we love? And unfortunately, the world has turned love into, once again, accepting anything and everything to prove that you love. But there are times when we love that we have to speak truth. That doesn't mean they're going to accept it. That doesn't mean they're going to like it. I believe my parents loved me when they raised me, and I guarantee you there were times that they spoke truth into my life, either verbally or physically, because they loved me. And they wanted me to grow in a certain way, to honor people and to respect people and to respect truth and stuff like that. And they did that because if they didn't, they knew that they would raise a rebel. And so it's the same thing for us. When someone asked me that, I said, you got to keep loving, but you got to love based on the truth. And if they tell you, I don't want to hear anything from you again, then you move to a place of prayer. You just keep praying and pray that God will give you the opportunity to share with them again. You know, if someone tells you, I don't want you to speak, don't try to overwhelm them with your personality. Overwhelm with prayer. Prayer still changes things. Amen. So it's a hard thing, because we are at that time when everything is turned upside down. So when you speak the truth, biblical truth, it sounds strange to the world around you. You need to know that. As a matter of fact, it has been turned, your biblical truth or the biblical truth has been turned into something ugly today. This is the sinful thing today, not the sinful acts of society. And the church needs to know where it stands. Our colors need to be clear. But we need to, but in saying that, we need to march that way as Jesus would. Not as a militant group trying to overthrow people and societies and taking up arms for this thing. We need to walk in the power of the Holy Spirit. Because what's the Bible say? Our weapons are not carnal. We don't do as the world does. But our weapons are mighty in God for bringing down strongholds. Seems like it. I know. It seems like the strongholds are winning. It seems like we're... And we are. We are the minority. But, every once in a while, we see the Holy Spirit touch one life. We see one life change, one heart change. There's no better feeling in the world. I'd love for the whole thing to happen. But praise God for that one life. Church, we have to know where we stand. All the security, at the point of today's lesson, all the security that the world can offer means nothing. And it will come to nothing. So we need to learn now to put our trust in Jesus. Okay? And we need to stop there. Let's pray.